This is day two of this February 2010 two-day sesshin. And today, what happens is if I get a little breath on the microphone, well, you heard what happened. Okay. We're going to be reading from A New Earth by Eckhart Tolle. A lot of you may be familiar with this book. It is a devastatingly accurate, deep analysis of ego and the problems that come from this. Eckhart Tolle is not a Zen Buddhist. He came to his awakening through a profound spiritual surrender after some years of deep depression and great pain. And the chapter we're going to be reading to continue our theme of pain is called The Pain Body. He says, "The greater part of most people's thinking is involuntary, automatic, and repetitive. It is no more than a kind of mental static and fulfills no real purpose. Strictly speaking, you don't think. Thinking happens to you. The statement, I think, implies volition. It implies that you have a say in the matter, that there is a choice involved in your part. For the most part, this is not the case. I think is just a false statement, just as false a statement as I digest, I circulate my blood. Digestion happens, circulation happens, thinking happens. The voice in the head has a life of its own. Most people are at the mercy of that voice. They are possessed by thought, by the mind, with a small m. And since the mind is conditioned by the past, you are then forced to reenact the past again and again. The Eastern term for this is karma. When you are identified with that voice, you don't know this, of course. If you knew it, you would no longer be possessed, because you are only truly possessed when you make the mistake, the possessing when you mistake the possessing entity for who you are. That is to say, when you become it. For thousands of years, humanity has been increasingly mind-possessed, failing to recognize the possessing entity as not self. Through a complete identification with the mind, a false sense of self, the ego, came into existence. The density of the ego depends on the degree to which you, the consciousness, are identified with your mind, with thinking. Thinking is no more than a tiny aspect of the totality of consciousness, the totality of who you are." Yasutani Roshi actually made the very same statement when he picked up a pen. He said, if this is mind, he says, the thinking mind is only the little ball at the very end of the pen. The degree of identification with the mind differs from person to person. Some people enjoy periods of freedom from it, however brief, and the peace, joy, and aliveness they experience in those moments makes life worth living. These are also the moments when creativity, love, and compassion arise. Others are trapped in the egoic state. They are alienated from themselves as well as from others and the world around them. When you look at them, you may see tension in their face, perhaps the furrowed brow or the absent or staring expression in their eyes. Most of their attention is absorbed by thinking, and so they don't really see you, and they are not really listening to you. They're not present in any situation, their attention being either in the past or future, which of course exist only in the mind as thought forms. Or they relate to you through some kind of role they play, and so are not themselves. Most people are alienated from who they are, and some are alienated to such a degree that the way they behave and interact is recognized as phony by almost everyone, except those who are equally phony, equally alienated from who they are. Alienation means you don't feel at ease in any situation, any place, or with any person, not even with yourself. You are always trying to get home, but never feel at home. Some of the greatest writers of the 20th century, such as Franz Kafka, Albert Camus, T.S. Eliot, and James Joyce, recognized alienation as the universal dilemma of human existence. Probably felt it deeply within themselves, and so were able to express it brilliantly in their works. They don't offer a solution. Their contribution is to show us a reflection of the human predicament so that we can see it more clearly. To see one's predicament clearly is a first step toward going beyond it. The birth of emotion, this next section. In addition to the movement of thought, although not entirely separate, there is another dimension to the ego, emotion. This is not to say that all thinking and all emotion are of the ego. They turn into ego only when you identify with them, when they take you over completely. That is to say, when they become I. The physical organism, your body, has its own intelligence, as does the organism of every other life form. And that intelligence reacts to what your mind is saying, reacts to your thoughts. So emotion is the body's reaction to your mind. The body's intelligence, of course, an inseparable part of the universal intelligence, one of its countless manifestations. It gives temporary cohesion to the atoms and molecules that make up your physical organism. It is the organizing principle behind the workings of all the organs of the body, the conversion of oxygen and food into energy, the heartbeat and the circulation of the blood, the immune system that protects the body from invaders, the translation of sensory input into nerve impulses that are sent to the brain, decoded there, and reassembled into a coherent inner picture of outer reality. All these, as well as thousands of other simultaneously occurring functions, are coordinated perfectly by that intelligence. You don't run your body, the intelligence does. It is also in charge of the organism's responses to its environment. This is true of any life form. It is the same intelligence that brought the plant into physical form and then manifests as the flower that comes out of the plant, the flower that opens its petals in the morning to receive the rays of the sun and closes them at nighttime. It's the same intelligence that manifests as Gaia. I don't know, this is his word for the complex living being that is planet Earth. It's spelled G-A-I-A. I think it's Eckhart Tolle's word, but he may have gotten it from the Bible or some other source. Probably he did, but I'm not really familiar with this. This intelligence gives rise to instinctive reactions of the organism to any threat or challenge. It produces responses in animals that appear to be akin to human emotions, anger, fear, pleasure. These instinctive responses could be considered primordial forms of emotion. In certain situations, human beings experience instinctive responses in the same way that animals do. In the face of danger, when the survival of the organism is threatened, the heart beats faster, the muscles contract, breathing becomes rapid in preparation for fight or flight. Primordial fear. When being cornered, a sudden flare-up of intense energy gives strength to the body that it didn't have before. Primordial anger. These instinctive responses appear akin to emotions, but are not emotions in the true sense of the word. The fundamental difference between an instinctive response and an emotion is this. An instinctive response is the body's direct response to some external situation. An emotion, on the other hand, is the body's response to a thought. Indirectly, an emotion can be a response to an actual situation or event, but it will be a response to the event seen through the filter of a mental impression, the filter of thought, that is to say, through the mental concepts of good and bad, like and dislike, me and mine. For example, it is likely you won't feel any emotion when you're told that someone's car has been stolen. But when it's your car, you will probably feel upset. It's amazing how much emotion a little mental concept like my can generate. Although the body is very intelligent, it cannot tell the difference between an actual situation and a thought. It reacts to every thought as if it were a reality. It doesn't know that it's just a thought. To the body, a worrisome, fearful thought means I am in danger, and it responds accordingly. Even though you may be lying in a warm and comfortable bed at night, the heart beats faster, muscles contract, breathing becomes rapid. There's a mental buildup of energy, but since the danger is only a mental fiction, the energy has no outlet. Part of it is fed back to the mind and generates even more anxious thought. The rest of the energy turns toxic and interferes with the harmonious functioning of the body. Emotions and the ego. The ego is not only the unobserved mind, the voice in the head which pretends to be you, but also the unobserved emotions that are the body's reaction to what the voice in the head is saying. We have already seen what kind of thinking the egoic voice engages in most of the time. That is the first third of this book. We see that. Anyway, we've already seen what kind of thinking the egoic voice engages in most of the time, and the dysfunction inherent in the structure of its thought processes, regardless of content. This dysfunctional thinking is what the body reacts to with negative emotion. The voice in the head tells a story that the body believes in and reacts to. Those reactions are emotions. The emotions in turn feed back energy to the thoughts that created the emotion in the first place. This is the vicious cycle between unexamined thoughts and emotions, giving rise to emotional thinking and emotional story making. At the end, this is a Dharma talk, not a Taisho. So at the end, I'd like to end my reading here. I probably won't comment on this too much, but I'd like to open it up to questions if anybody wants to raise any questions. The emotional component of ego differs from person to person. In some egos, it's greater than in others. Thoughts that trigger emotional responses in the body may sometimes come so fast that before the mind has had time to voice them, the body has already responded with an emotion, and the emotion has turned into a reaction. Those thoughts exist at a pre-verbal stage and could be called unconscious assumptions. They have their origin in a person's past conditioning, usually from early childhood. Quote, people cannot be trusted, unquote, would be an example of such an unconscious assumption in a person whose primordial relationships, that is to say, with parents and siblings, were not supportive and did not inspire trust. Here are a few more common unconscious assumptions. Nobody respects and appreciates me. I need to fight to survive. There's never enough money. Life always lets you down. I don't deserve abundance, or I don't deserve love. Unconscious assumptions create emotions in the body, which in turn generate mind activity and or instant reactions. In this way, they create your personal reality. The voice of ego continually disrupts the body's natural state of well-being. Almost every body is under a great deal of strain and stress, not because it's threatened by some external factor, but from within the mind. The body has an ego attached to it, and it cannot but respond to all the dysfunctional thought patterns that make up the ego. Thus, a stream of negative emotion accompanies the stream of incessant and compulsive thinking. What is a negative emotion? An emotion that is toxic to the body and interferes with its balance and harmonious functioning. Fear, anxiety, anger, bearing a grudge, sadness, hatred or intense dislike, jealousy, envy, all disrupt the energy flow through the body, affect the heart, the immune system, digestion, production of hormones, and so on. Even mainstream medicine, although it knows very little about how the ego operates yet, is beginning to recognize the connection between negative emotional states and physical disease. An emotion that does harm to the body also infects the people you come in contact with, and indirectly, through a process of chain reaction, countless others you never meet. There's a generic term for all negative emotions: unhappiness. Do positive emotions then have the opposite effect on the physical body? Do they strengthen the immune system, invigorate and heal the body? They do indeed. But we need to differentiate between positive emotions that are ego-generated and deeper emotions that emanate from your natural state of connectedness with being. Positive emotions generated by the ego already contain within themselves their opposite, into which they can quickly turn. Here are some examples. What the ego calls love is possessiveness and addictive clinging that can turn to hate within a second. Anticipation about an upcoming event, which is the ego's overvaluation of future, easily turns into its opposite, letdown or disappointment, when the event is over or doesn't fulfill the ego's expectations. Praise and recognition make you feel alive and happy one day. Being criticized or ignored make you dejected and unhappy the next. The pleasure of a wild party turns into bleakness and a hangover the next morning. There is not good without bad, no high without low. Ego-generated emotions are derived from the mind's identification with external factors, which are, of course, unstable and liable to change at any moment. The deeper emotions are not really emotions at all, but states of being. Emotions exist within the realm of opposites. States of being can be obscured, but they have no opposite. They emanate from within you as the love, joy, and peace that are aspects of your true nature. It's interesting, he uses a lot of the same words that Zen does, true nature. That he's basically a Christian, and he's teaching Christians, but this is from a very deep awakening and is fundamentally right on target. The duck with a human mind. In an earlier book, The Power of Now, I mentioned my observation that after two ducks get into a fight, which never lasts long, they will separate and float off in opposite directions. Then each duck will flap its wings vigorously a few times, thus releasing the surplus energy that built up during the fight. After they flap their wings, they float on peacefully, as if nothing ever happened. I want to come back to this kind of release after that you can, there are ways you can partake of this flapping of wings of the duck as a human being and release some of this poisonous stuff that can build up within one. We can talk about that later. If the duck had a human mind, it would keep the fight alive by thinking, by story making. This would probably be the duck's story. I don't believe in what he just did. He came within 5 inches of me. He thinks he owns this pond. He has no consideration for my private space. I'll never trust him again. Next time he'll try something else just to annoy me. I'm sure he's plotting something already, but I'm not going to stand for this. I'm going to teach him a lesson he won't forget. And on the mind spins its tails, still thinking and talking about it days, months, or years later. As far as the body is concerned, the fight is still continuing, and the energy it generates in response to all those thoughts is emotion, which in turn generates more thinking. This becomes the emotional thinking of the ego. You can see how problematic the duck's life would be if it had a human mind. But this is how most humans live all the time. No situation or event is ever really finished. The mind and the mind made me and my story keep it going. We are a species that's lost its way. Everything natural, every flower or tree, and every animal have important lessons to teach us if we would only stop, look, and listen. Our duck's lesson is this: flap your wings, which translates as let go of the story and return to the only place of power, the present moment. Carrying the past. The inability, or rather unwillingness, of the human mind to let go of the past is beautifully illustrated in the story of two Zen monks, Tanzan and Aikido, who were walking along a country road that had become extremely muddy after heavy rains. Near a village, they came upon a young woman who was trying to cross the road, but the mud was so deep it would have ruined a silk kimono she was wearing. Tanzan at once picked her up and carried her to the other side. The monks walked on in silence. 5 hours later, as they were approaching the lodging temple, Aikido couldn't restrain himself any longer. "Why did you carry that girl across the road?" he says. "We monks are not supposed to do things like that." "I put the girl down hours ago," said Tanzan. "Are you still carrying her?" Now imagine what life would be like for someone who lived like Aikido all the time, unable or unwilling to let go internally of situations, accumulating more and more stuff inside, and you get a sense of what life is like for the majority of people on our planet. What a heavy burden of the past they carry around with them in their minds. The past lives in you as memories, but memories in themselves are not a problem. In fact, it is through memory that we learn from our past and from past mistakes. It is only when memories, that is to say, thoughts about the past, take you over completely that they turn into a burden, turn problematic, and become part of your sense of self. Your personality, which is conditioned by the past, then becomes your prison. Your memories are invested with a sense of self, and your story becomes who you perceive yourself to be. This, quote, little me, unquote, is an illusion that obscures your true identity as timeless and formless presence. Timeless and formless presence. Now, here. Nothing. How could that be our true identity? Your story, however, consists not only of mental but also of emotional memory, old emotion that is being revived continuously. As in the case of the monk who carried the burden of his resentment for 5 hours by feeding it with his thoughts, most people carry a large amount of unnecessary baggage, both mental and emotional, throughout their lives. They limit themselves through grievances, regret, hostility, guilt. Their emotional thinking has become their self, and so they hang on to old emotion because it strengthens their identity. Because of the human tendency to perpetuate old emotion, almost everyone carries his or her energy field, an accumulation of old emotional pain, which I will call the pain body. We can, however, stop adding to the pain body that we already have. We can learn to break the habit of accumulating and perpetuating old emotion by flapping our wings, metaphorically speaking, and refrain from mentally dwelling on the past, regardless of whether something happened yesterday or 30 years ago. We can learn not to keep situations or events alive in our mind, but to return our attention continuously to the pristine, timeless, present moment rather than be caught up in mental movie making. Our very presence then becomes our identity rather than our thoughts and emotions. This is what we have here in this wonderful dharma, this sesshin, this training. This is what we have. We have a way to return our attention to continuously to the pristine, timeless moment, rather than being caught up in mental movie making. But, as we all know, there's nothing easy about this. Now, individual and collective. Any negative emotion that is not fully faced and seen for what it is in the moment arises, the moment it arises, does not completely dissolve. It leaves behind a remnant of pain. Children in particular find strong negative emotions too overwhelming to cope with and will tend to try not to feel them. In the absence of a fully conscious adult who guides them with love and compassionate understanding into facing the emotion directly, choosing not to feel it is indeed the only option for the child at the time. Unfortunately, that early defense mechanism usually remains in place when the child becomes an adult. The emotion still lives in him or her unrecognized and manifests indirectly, for example, as anxiety, anger, outbursts of violence, a mood, or even illness. In some cases, it interferes with or sabotages every intimate relationship. Most psychotherapists have met patients who claimed initially to have had a totally happy childhood, and later the opposite turned out to be true. That was true in my case, actually. Those may be the more extreme cases, but nobody can go through childhood without suffering emotional pain. Even if both of your parents were enlightened, you would still find yourself growing up in a largely unconscious world. The remnants of pain left behind by a very strong negative emotion that is not fully faced, accepted, and then let go of, join together to form an energy field that lives in the very cells of your body. It consists not just of childhood pain, but also painful emotions that were added to it later, in adolescence and during your adult life, much of it created by the voice of the ego. It is the emotional pain that is your unavoidable companion when a false sense of self is the basis of your life. This energy field of old but still very much active emotion that lives in almost every human being is the pain body. The pain body, however, is not just individual in nature. It also partakes of the pain suffered by countless humans throughout the history of humanity, which is a history of continuous tribal warfare, of enslavement, pillage, rape, torture, and other forms of violence. This pain still lives in the collective psyche of humanity and is being added to on a daily basis, as you can verify when you watch the news tonight or look at the drama in people's relationships. The collective pain body is probably encoded within every human's DNA, although we haven't discovered it there yet. Actually, it may be in what's now called the epigenome, which is a kind of layer of memory that can be transferred from one generation to the other, and it doesn't affect the DNA, but that's an entirely different scientific story which can't get into here. Every newborn who comes into this world already carries an emotional pain body. Newborn. In some it is heavier, more dense than in others. Some babies are quite happy most of the time. Others seem to carry an enormous amount of unhappiness within them. It is true that some babies cry a great deal because they are not given enough love or attention, but others cry for no apparent reason, almost as if they were trying to make everyone around them as unhappy as they are, and often they succeed. They have come into this world with a heavy share of human pain. Other babies may cry frequently because they can sense the emanation of their mother's or father's negative emotion, and it causes them pain, and also causes their pain body to grow already by absorbing energy from the parents' pain bodies. Whatever the case may be, as the baby's physical body grows, so does the pain body. An infant with only a light pain body is not necessarily going to be a spiritually more advanced man or woman than someone with a dense one. In fact, the opposite is often the case. People with heavy pain bodies usually have a better chance to awaken spiritually than those with a relatively light one. Whereas some of them do remain trapped in their heavy pain bodies, many others reach a point where they cannot live with their unhappiness any longer, so their motivation to awaken becomes strong. Why is the suffering body of Christ, his face distorted in agony and his body bleeding from countless wounds, such a significant issue image in the collective consciousness of humanity? Millions of people, particularly in medieval times, would not have related to it as deeply as they did if something within themselves had not resonated with it, if they had not unconsciously recognized it as an outer representation of their own inner reality, the pain body. They were not yet conscious enough to recognize it directly within themselves, but it was the beginning of their becoming aware of it. Christ can be seen as the archetypal human, embodying both the pain and the possibility of transcendence. How the pain body renews itself. The pain body is a semi-autonomous energy form that lives within most human beings, an entity made up of emotion. It has its own primitive intelligence, not unlike a cunning animal, and its intelligence is directed primarily at survival. Like all life forms, it periodically needs to feed, to take in new energy, and the food it requires to replenish itself consists of energy that is compatible with its own, which is to say, energy that vibrates at a similar frequency. Any emotionally painful experience can be used as food by the pain body. That's why it thrives on negative thinking as well as drama in relationships. The pain body is an addiction to unhappiness. It may be shocking when you realize for the first time that there's something within you that periodically seeks emotional negativity, seeks unhappiness. You need even more awareness to see it in yourself than to recognize it in another person. Once the unhappiness has taken you over, not only do you want an end to it, not only do you not want an end to it, but you want to make others just as miserable as you are in order to feed on their negative emotional reactions. In most people, the pain body has a dormant and an active stage. When it's dormant, you can easily forget that you're carrying a dark, heavy cloud or a dormant volcano inside of you, depending on the energy field of your particular pain body. How long it remains dormant varies from person to person. A few weeks is the most common, but it can be a few days or months. In rare cases, the pain body can lie in hibernation for years before it gets triggered by some event. How the pain body feeds on your thoughts. The pain body awakens from its dormancy when it gets hungry, when it's time to replenish itself. Alternatively, it may get triggered by an event at any time. The pain body that is ready to feed can use the most insignificant event as a trigger, something somebody says or does, or even thought. If you live alone and there's nobody around at the time, the pain body will feed on your thoughts. Suddenly, your thinking becomes deeply negative. You are most likely unaware that just prior to the influx of negative thinking, a wave of emotion invaded your mind as a dark and heavy mood, as anxiety or fiery anger. All thought is energy, and the pain body is now feeding on the energy of your thoughts. But it can't feed on any thought. You don't need to be particularly sensitive to notice that a positive thought has a totally different feeling tone than a negative one. It's the same energy, but it vibrates at a different frequency. A happy, positive thought is indigestible to the pain body. It can only feed on negative thoughts because only those thoughts are compatible with its own energy field. You know, I want to say at this time, if you watch your life closely, you'll see at least some of this happening. I certainly do. His analysis here, it's the first time I've read anything quite like this, but it really is recognizable. All things... Oh, wow. All things are vibrating with energy fields in ceaseless motion. The chair you sit on, the book you are holding in your hands appear solid and motionless only because that is how your senses perceive their vibrational frequency. That is to say, the incessant movement of the molecules, atoms, electrons, and subatomic particles that together create what you perceive as a chair, a book, a tree, a body. What we perceive as physical matter is energy vibrating, moving at a particular range of frequencies. Thoughts consist of the same energy vibrating at a higher frequency than matter, which is why they cannot be seen or touched. Thoughts have their own range of frequencies, with negative thoughts at the lower end of the scale and positive thoughts at the higher. The vibrational frequency of the pain body resonates with that of negative thoughts, which is why only those thoughts can feed the pain body. The usual pattern of thought creating emotion is reversed in the case of the pain body, at least initially. Emotion from the pain body quickly gains control of your thinking, and once your mind has been taken over by the pain body, your thinking becomes negative. The voice in your head will be telling sad, anxious, or angry stories about yourself or your life, about other people, about past, future, or imaginary events. The voice will be blaming, accusing, complaining, imagining, and you are totally identified with whatever the voice says. Believe all its distorted thoughts. At that point, the addiction to unhappiness has set in. It's not so much that you can't stop the train of negative thoughts, but you don't want to. This is because your pain body at that time is living through you, pretending to be you. And to the pain body, pain is pleasure. It eagerly devours every negative thought. In fact, the usual voice in your head has now become the voice of the pain body. It's taken over the internal dialogue. A vicious cycle becomes established between the pain body and your thinking. Every thought feeds the pain body, and in turn, the pain body generates more thoughts. At some point, after a few hours or even a few days, it has replenished itself and returns to the dormant stage, leaving behind a depleted organism and a body that is much more susceptible to illness. If that sounds to you like a psychic parasite, you're right. That's exactly what it is. How this pain body feeds on drama. If there are other people around, preferably your partner or a close family member, the pain body will attempt to provoke them, push their buttons, as the expression goes, so it can feed on the ensuing drama. Pain bodies love intimate relationships and families because that's where they get most of their food. It's hard to resist another person's pain body that is determined to draw you into a reaction. Instinctively, it knows your weakest, most vulnerable points. If it doesn't succeed the first time, it will try again and again. It is raw emotion looking for more emotion. The other person's pain body wants to awaken yours so that both pain bodies can mutually energize each other. Many relationships go through violent and destructive pain body episodes at regular intervals. It's almost unbearably painful for a young child to have to witness the emotional violence of their parents' pain bodies. And yet that is the fate of millions of children all over the world, the nightmare of their daily existence. That is also one of the main ways in which the human pain body is passed on from generation to generation. After each episode, the partners make up, and there's an interval of relative peace, and to the limited extent that the ego allows it. Excessive consumption of alcohol will often activate the pain body, particularly in men, but also in some women. When a person becomes drunk, he goes through a complete personality change as the pain body takes him over. A deeply unconscious person whose pain body habitually replenishes itself through physical violence often directs it toward his spouse or children. When he becomes sober, he is truly sorry and may say he will never do this again, and he means it. The person who is talking and making promises, however, is not the entity that commits the violence. And so you can be sure that it will happen again and again unless he becomes present, recognizes the pain body within himself, and thus disidentifies from it. In some cases, counseling can help him do that. Most pain bodies want to inflict and suffer pain, but some are predominantly either perpetrators or victims. In either case, they feed on violence, whether emotional or physical. Some couples who may think they have fallen in love are actually feeling drawn to the other because of their respective pain bodies complement each other. Sometimes the role of perpetrator and victim are clearly prescribed from the first time they met. Some marriages that are thought to be made in heaven are actually made in hell. I want to break off here now because I think there's more to read here, and it goes along these lines. It's a bit repetitive, and but I wanted to present this because I think that a lot of us can do well to start to recognize these patterns. So I want to open this up, please, to any questions you might have or comments about this or whatever. Yes, John.
The difficulty I have with the concept of pain body is it feels almost divorced from myself. And it seems to put responsibility for negativity on another
mm-hmm.
rather than taking responsibility for myself.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that?
I see his point in doing this. You lay out a conceptual pattern which can be something that can help people recognize something. It doesn't mean he's laying out the ultimate truth here. He's laying something out he wants people to see going on in themselves, and this is his way of doing it. So I wouldn't take the words too seriously. Yeah, as one comes to consciousness, one starts to be able to take responsibility and make changes. But what he's talking about is something that when we're unconscious human beings, it's something that functions as an animal within us that we really don't have any control of as long as we're unconscious. And so that's his point. Not that it's an ultimate truth. It's something we can overcome, especially with practice. And, yes, Dwayne.
Material was flowing past pretty fast there, but in answer to your dialogue with John, I believe he was saying that our ego sense of self is inauthentic, that the actual intelligence which bears responsibility for the acts that the body goes through is the more organic intelligence of the whole body, and inevitably the acts of the ego, the responsibility falls on this organic intelligence.
Yeah.
So the ego claim sorrow and repentance, but unless our ego manages one way or another to reclaim the sense of that organic intelligence, all such maneuvers are just more ego maneuvers. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, pretty much right. We need to awaken to this basic intelligence. We need to awaken to this basic intelligence to be able to undo the past. The all this pain body is stuff that we've kept from the past. And when we start to awaken to the present, it gives us the ability to start to take control of our lives in a new way. Again, I think that we don't want to reify these concepts too much. It's important to see that he's just using certain things in ways that, but it is awakening, becoming conscious, seeing what's going on in us that enables us to become free of it. That's the main point here. Devin.
I heard an interview on the radio with Eckhart Tolle some months back, and And he brought up the concept of the pain body. And I remember him indicating that he first came up with this idea when he was meeting with students, and he was finding that they would have emotional response tremendously greater than the warrant, than the situation suggested.
Right.
And then he talked about the pain body as you did there, and I immediately thought of my parents who are still together, but they fight quite a bit, and when my brother and I are visiting, often my dad will say something quite small and my mom will erupt into anger, and when we question her, say, Mom, he just said this, but then when she responds, it's as if she's accessing that pain body, going back, weeks ago, and then months ago, oh, he always does this, and it's so she's not consciously, obviously, that it's like initial reaction, tremendously disproportionate to the situation I presented, but she can go on 20 minutes, and the anger is just welling up, and it's exhausting.
You've hit it right on the head. I mean, that's exactly what he's talking about, that we don't, when we're operating out of this history of our pain that we are carrying around, then we're not in control. We're not rational. It's just a powerful force that takes us over. It's as if a beast in us takes over. But I mean, you don't want to reify this concept of beast now and then. But it is. He's pointing to some really important things, really important observations about how karma works, and he called it karma in this chapter. Go ahead. I saw another hand here, but Alice, no, Truman.
Yeah, I just wanted to. What he's talking about in your comments, it just really resonates with my own personal experience. I mean, I was one of those people that thought I had a happy childhood, and until I started Zen practice and did some stints of therapy, I had no idea. I mean, I don't think I had a horrible childhood. I didn't have physical abuse. But just really strongly, even just right now, I don't even know how to express it because it's just emotions coming up. I got into therapy and I had no idea. And then these things just started coming. I suppressed some things for such a long time. And then that therapy was for me, that access that allowed me to become aware of it, self-awareness.
Yeah.
Of my own body pain, what happened to me. Much younger. So.
Yeah, and if you carry that awareness, develop that awareness on, you get more and more free of it. This thing points to some very important things to observe going on within oneself. It's also great. The pain body only wants pain for food, but this also gives us the enormous impetus to practice when we start to recognize these patterns in ourselves and realize just with one sighting that's not enough. It's a long process of becoming free of this stuff, especially if one was treated badly as a child or forced to witness extreme negativity in the family and elsewhere. Was it Alice? Alice, go ahead.
You mentioned in the text they were talking about the ducks flapping their wings.
Yes.
I'd like to hear more about that.
Yeah.
What we can do.
You know, one thing you can do is actually scream. I mean, if you're alone. You know, you're really frustrated. You feel these enormous churning and stuff. I've recently tried this a bit, and so it actually works. I mean, and you could also go for a run and do something physically very vigorous. And some people cry to get this release and that, but others are kind of blocked from crying. So there are other ways, and one can find one's own way. But it has to be something, I think, rather intensely physical that involves you completely, and that's the key, that you're really concentrating that thing, and that's what can give you this release from the, that's what can,
a friend of mine, she told me that she was doing in such situations. She opened the window and was like, you know, brushing off dust and shaking off her arms.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it really works. I mean, yeah. Try it.
We lived in Vietnam for a number of years, and Errol and I during the war there, and there was a woman next door to us, and I could never understand. Was she just every couple of days she just starts screaming at the top of her lungs, and it was a little hard to bear. But now I understand what she was doing, because that was a hellish war, and her husband was in the military, and yeah. Jerry.
I can relate somewhat to yoga too, because in doing some of the yoga postures, things come up.
Mm-hmm.
I know when I was with Francois, he would always say, "What's the story? When you hit that resistance in the posture,
mm-hmm.
when you can't go any further, what's the story?" And it took a couple years before I related what that really meant when memories started to flow up.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I appreciate about this reading is that it's a really kind of the five skandhas, in the sense that, you know, when we start to get into perception, memories, and then forgetting the fifth one,
mm-hmm.
and it all goes backwards through to sensation,
mm-hmm.
where we try to define our reality.
And mm-hmm.
as he pointed out, you're pointing out, there is no reality. And so, even sitting, I mean, the last session I was at, boy, my body just went through a whole bunch of changes, and
mm-hmm.
pain and suffering just mm-hmm. welled right up.
Right.
And all I could do was cry.
Mm-hmm. I've heard other yoga practitioners actually say the very same thing about getting into some of the yoga postures, that it's actually... there are psychological things that need to come up and out before you can do that. So that would be something too to look at.
So even in practice, then doing Zen practice, what's your experience with things coming up for people? I mean, you know, sitting, you're counting, you're doing all these things, and for a lot of people, you know, stuff surfaces. And how do you handle that?
One important thing is to share with others. If you hold this stuff within yourself, you're not going to do as well as if you have a confidant. It's somebody who you can trust, who you're going to share this stuff with. And I think that's one big thing. That's kind of like flapping your wings. The thing about it coming up is you're seeing, when it comes up, that's the seeing through it right there. That's the seeing that it's what's operating you. What by the time it's conscious, it no longer operates you as effectively as it would when it's still unconscious. So Zazen, in this concentration of the mind, we start to squeeze out the impurities, and this stuff comes up as a part of the process of Zazen and Zen training. And so it's a good thing. It enables us to see where we're. See those things and become free of them. But of course, it's just it's step by step. It's incremental. And is that, are you driving at something else that I need to get? Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Betsy.
This whole concept of stopping the storytelling is really meaningful to me. I didn't have a happy childhood, and did lots of therapy. And I can remember years ago, the therapist saying to me, "Well, just let go of it." Well, saying it and doing it were two really different things, and. There was a lot of conflict between my sister and I, and it really came to a head when my mother died, and we were going through all the funeral ritual and then just at each other's throats. And for months, I just held that in me, and I kept thinking, well, she's wrong, and waiting for her to do something, and we didn't talk, then I read the Dalai Lama's book on forgiveness, and I thought, well, yeah, she needs to ask me to be. But then all of a sudden it came to me, well, maybe I should try. And it was such a life-affirming experience. And, you know, this whole thing about storytelling, it's hard. I've suffered depression my whole life. And before I started practicing Zen, I finally was on a medication that helped. And I felt so relieved. And then since I've been practicing Zen, I haven't had to use it anymore. I don't know how to explain that. It's such a mystery, but it just seems like it works. And the fact that, you know, you don't have to tell stories to yourself anymore is such a good thing.
Yeah, that's wonderful, Betsy. I think we have to cut it off here. We have to learn about how to use this microphone. It's not immediate. okay, we need to stop now and recite the four vows.